Welcome to the Wildlife Health Talks. I'm your host, Kat, and this is our seventh episode introducing WDA members and their amazing work all over the world. Today, I'm taking you on a trip to the beautiful city of Vienna in Austria. My guest today is Dr. Friederike Pollin. Fidu is a wildlife health veterinarian and anesthesiologist at the Research Institute of Wildlife Ecology at the Veterinary University of Vienna. She has been taking care of the large and small animals of the South African savannah and the Austrian forests. Welcome to the show, Fidu.
Hi, Kat. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Fidu, let's start with some WDA questions, as we usually do. When did you join the WDA?
I joined the WDA about 10 years ago, just when I graduated from vet school.
And what does the WDA mean to you?
So, of course, I love the WDA's mission. And I think the most important thing for me is the vertical and horizontal exchange the association offers. So I think it's so important to work interdisciplinary, which the WDA does. So there's so many disciplines coming together when working with wildlife health and disease. So it's not only veterinarians, it's also biologists, epidemiologists, virologists, and people from all sorts of backgrounds, which I really love and enforces collaboration, which is amazing. And then obviously also the vertical exchange. So from high professionals all the way down to students. So there's so much student mentorship that is being offered. And as already mentioned in your previous podcast, it's a very let's say laid back community. You can feel free and open to, ask basically anything you want to professionals that are already very established and get amazing career advice. So I think that is amazing.
Nice. And what's your favorite experience that's related to the WDA?
I've been thinking about that. I mean, there were several occasions that were amazing. So I did as a student. So after vet school, I did a master's studies. And as a master's student, I was country representative Austria of the European Wildlife Disease Association student chapter. And we did a few fun lecture evenings and field trips, which were a lot of fun. But then also I got to join the EWDA conference in Berlin, and at the mentor mixer, I got some very, very helpful advice from some of the mentors that I'm actually still following and that I have been following all the way through. And I think, as I already mentioned before, that is probably one of the most valuable things the association has to offer to young researchers or veterinarians like me, just to get a little bit of guidance, because there's so many opportunities and sometimes you get lost because there's everything is interesting, and some advice is sometimes just what you need.
Yeah, awesome. That sounds great. So let's move back to your actual work, or let's start with your PhD. So you did a really cool PhD at the University of Pretoria in South Africa on rhino anesthesia. What are the challenges, or what were the challenges working with rhinos?
But working with rhinos, of course, they're gigantic animals with a very thick skin. And so my PhD was about investigating translocation stress or physiological challenges that occur during translocation in rhinos. And translocation includes the capture, then there might be some temporary captivity, then the transport itself, and then the release in a novel environment. And particularly the first part, the capture, is very challenging. With large wild animals like the rhino, because first of all, they get very stressed by the chase with the helicopter when you catch them, and then the etorphine, which is a ultra potent opioid that we use for immobilization of rhinos. Then once they are in recumbency, there's so many physiological challenges like the respiratory depression, ventilation perfusion mismatch. They get a rigid chest, the chest excursions are not so full anymore like they should be. They're tremoring, they get hyperthermia, hypertension. So you can imagine that their body pH, the blood pH, gets very low. And so I think anesthesia in those animals is a huge, huge challenge. And then the next point during translocation. So once the capture is over and they're standing up and their physiology gets normalizes a bit from that acute stress and anesthesia, they are being put in transport crates and translocated over very long distances sometimes. And I feel like wildlife regulations are not as detailed as you know from domestic animals. So transports can sometimes be very, very long, and the animals don't really drink or eat. Sometimes because they don't want to, because they're wild animals and they're not used to whatever you offer them, or because they're still quite stressed, which means that there will be some physiological challenges that develop over the long term, like they might be getting hungry, they might be getting thirsty. So those, I think, would be the main challenges that that we were looking at during my PhD. We were also...
I was about to ask about the translocation, like why is it necessary? But if you want to add something to the challenges, you go ahead.
No, I can. You can ask about why okay. Translocation. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. So you mentioned the translocations. Why is it actually necessary to fly or drive rhinos around South Africa and probably other African states all the time?
I think there's two. Main different types of translocations. So the one would be for commercial purposes and the other one for conservation. So we are talking about conservation translocations now, where the aim is to aid the status of the species. And when you look at the human population, which just increased massively over the past decades, you can imagine that people need a lot of space, that they also need a lot of food. So that means that there's always less and less space for our wild animals left. Their habitats get fragmented or they lose their habitat at all. Then there's things like climate change that put huge pressure on wildlife. And particularly in the rhino, we have droughts that become very important. And of course, with the rhino, the main issue for the rhino population to decrease is the poaching. So the rhino horn, which is nothing else like keratin, the same material as a fingernail, is being sold in some countries for medical purposes, which is obviously not true. And that puts huge poaching pressure on the animals. And some translocations are happening for safety reasons. There's sometimes hotspots where there's just a lot of poaching happening. And if it's a game farm, the owners sometimes decide to sell the animals and bring them to other places that are safer for the animals. So that would be one main reason for translocations in South Africa. But of course, coming back to the issue with the habitat fragmentation, translocations are also needed to provide genetic exchange and population growth. That's why I also think, not only for rhinos, but for what many wildlife species in general, translocations are becoming more and more important, because those issues that I pointed out before, they're also not disappearing. There's still more and more people and less space for wildlife. So that's why I think translocations are a big topic for the future also. And interestingly, I'll start talking about this topic and I can't stop it.
That's all right.
When you look at the CITES database, you can kind of track officially transported transports. And it's available open access on the internet, and you can just add any dates and species that you're interested to look at. And you can also see how the number of wildlife transports is just increasing and increasing. So that's why I think that topic is of high importance. Also in terms of, since this is a wildlife disease podcast, also in terms of wildlife diseases, because the stress that is associated with translocations has an effect on the immune system, which then has an effect on all the pathogens that the animal is hosting, which then also has an impact on pathogen and disease transmission, which then, if you put the animal into a new area, can have an impact on the environment, on human health. So it's all like connected in the big picture.
Is there actually, I'm just curious, is there actually any research done on, let's say, underlying issues with translocation? I'm just thinking, I guess where this is coming from is like in Australia, you have areas with a lot of koalas and you have areas with very few koalas, and these are like thousands of kilometers apart. And initially when I heard about this issue, I was like, oh, why don't you just move the koalas over there where they're needed in to kind of enrich the population? And then I learned like, ah, oh, no, like koalas, they are so sensitive. They might not have the right eucalypt species in the other place, and their microbiome is really like specialized for these, the eucalypts they have in their environment. Is it just that koalas are just such princesses and rhinos are fairly sturdy, and that's why they don't care? Or is there, do you think there is some underlying issue when you put a rhino like thousands of kilometers away in a different, well, in a similar habitat, but in a different place?
Yeah, of course there are underlying issues. So with wildlife translocation, they need to be planned like very thoroughly. So it's not only the animal itself you need to consider. It's, as you also said, it's the environment. More importantly, it's the communities and the people around. So they need to know that these animals are coming, and they need to be prepared. And ideally, they should be on board and be excited about it. And it's like the planning of a translocation. Not from a veterinary perspective, luckily, but it involves a lot of, habitat analysis and also post-release follow-up. And then with rhinos, there's an issue with the tsetse fly-infested areas when you bring them from tsetse fly-free areas to tsetse fly-infested areas that the animals might not be able to cope with the disease. So there are all these little things to consider. So that's why translocations are a huge effort and a huge interdisciplinary team effort, actually.
Oh yeah, that makes sense for sure. And one of my favorite stories of your PhD is one time you had to accompany several rhinos on a plane trip, and that was quite of an adventure. So what was the reason for that plane trip, and what was it like?
Yeah, I think I was just one of the luckiest PhD students ever. So I think it was my first year of my PhD. I got to join a rhino translocation from South Africa to Botswana as part of the Rhinos Without Borders initiative. So the idea was to take the rhinos away from high-risk poaching areas and bring them to a relatively safe environment. And I just got to fly with them. So my job was basically to take initial blood samples and then at the release area take blood samples again and just compare the capture versus release blood work. And yeah, it was obviously an amazing experience. I never thought anything like that would happen in my life. Just like little things. How is it gonna be in an airplane flying with rhinos? Are there gonna be seats? Is there gonna be like decompression? Is there gonna be light or whatever? So the there's no seats.
She
You just
was
try to like
sleeping on the ground, basically.
you just try to hold on and see what happens. It was certainly a great experience. Very thankful for my supervisors and everyone who made that possible
And it
for the
went all.
rhinos in the first place, but then also for me to be able to
Oh, for sure. And it went all well. So all rhinos, they survived and they did well in the new home.
join. Yes, all of them did very well, so that was a nice success of that translocation.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, sounds like a all around success story, really. So let's move on to the job you're doing at the moment. So you're part of the Wildlife Medicine Group of the Research Institute of Wildlife Ecology. What's the mission of your research group?
So our research group's mission is basically to teach, develop, and provide state-of-the-art species-specific wildlife medicine. So that means we have three main duties, I would say. So one is the teaching. So we are the Wildlife Medicine Group at the Veterinary University. So we have a lot of veterinary students that come through, which we supervise with their diploma thesis, but we also do lectures and a small wildlife immobilization course. Then we also provide a veterinary service to researchers in the country doing research on wildlife. So that includes projects. For example, at the moment, we are capturing deer just to place GPS collars. But there's also a lot of research in evolutional ecology at our institute, where people are looking at climate change and hibernation. And we are basically the veterinarians that place the little cute dormice in anesthesia to implant and explant data loggers that continuously log body temperature and heart rate throughout, I think, 2 years actually, are those loggers. So there's many like little things like that. And then we have, I mean, we also do have more than 1,000 animals at our institute and are responsible for the wildlife health and, you know, all the quarantine regulations and so on in those animals. And then we also have our own research projects.
What is it like to catch deer in the Austrian winter?
It's very cold. No, it's, yeah, I love it. But yeah, generally it's very cold. Our capture season is in the winter time. We're spending a lot of time outside. It's completely different to what I've been trained to in South Africa. We're actually working also sometimes rather late because that's when the animals tend to come to their feeding stations and they're easier to catch. It's a team effort, like always. We work very closely with the biologists. At the moment, we have a project with the University of Natural Resources. They are actually looking at to implement a mathematical model in the movement data of deer and need the GPS data. So that's why we are catching them and to place the collars on. So those animals do not get loggers. And yeah, we're spending a lot of time sitting outside,
waiting,
yeah. Waiting. It's like, hurry up and wait.
Why do you have to catch the deer in winter? Why not make it nice and comfortable in summer?
Yeah, that would be nice for us, right?
Yeah.
I think the main issues is just the stress and the potential hyperthermia that is associated with the hotter temperatures during the summer. So they're much more stable to work with and to anesthetize in the winter months. And so with the deer that we have at our institute, we would sometimes work in the summer as well. And we did a little opportunistic data collection where I've been looking at, you know, things like blood pressure, heart rate, oxygen saturation in summer and winter, and then animals placed in different recumbencies. And actually during the winter time, I mean, we always provide supplemental oxygen insufflation. But during the winter time, the SpO2s, which is the saturation of the hemoglobin with oxygen, we're always at around 100. So that's perfect. That's how we want it. And during the summertime, their metabolism is just much higher, and they became hypoxic much easier despite the oxygen insufflation. So working during the winter is just safer for the animals to provide the anesthesia.
I see. So it's either welfare of the welfare of the deer or the welfare of the humans that
yeah.
You can't
like
combine the two.
I feel like that's the anesthetist in me speaking. But then also if you work with the deer in the winter, we try to lure them to areas where we feed them so they're easier to catch. And that only just works in the winter where, you know, the ground is frozen and they don't get a lot of food anywhere else. I think in the summer they would not really come to the feeding stations. So that's a management point of view also.
Nice. And do you want to tell us a bit more about your the research projects you do on your own, which you're leading? What are you working on there?
Yeah, thanks. So at the moment, I'm still I'm continuing the rhino research in South Africa. So during my PhD, basically, some of the main findings were the dehydration during translocation. But now it's not so easy to water rhinos during transport because it's actually even stated in the CITES translocation guidelines that the animals might hurt themselves with water containers in the transport crates. And most of the time, they actually, if it's wild rhinos, they don't drink because they actually just don't know what it is. So now we're looking at ways to provide fluids to them. So is it possible to provide IV fluids to them during translocation? Can we do a rectal enema before transport? Can we do that during transport? Does it even make a difference if you do that? So those are the new questions that we try to answer, just to improve animal welfare during translocation.
Can I just, sorry if you do, can I just point this out? I always find it hilarious, especially having been surrounded, like myself, having worked with biologists for quite a while and being the only vet in my institute. It's just funny how we take things for granted. Like when you said you're testing if a rectal, sorry, what's the word again? The rectal enema.
Enema, fluid.
That's right.
Enema,
yeah. If the rectal enema, it might be a solution. And it's just hilarious. I mean, come on, like basically shoving some fluids up a rhino's bum. Like that's, it's pretty funny, but we just take it for granted, right? I find that hilarious. Okay, sorry, you go on.
That's true. Thanks. Thanks for pointing that out. yeah, and I'm also about to investigate some newer markers for stress and animal welfare. So now I want to look at oxidative DNA damage as an indicator for long-term stress, because the question is always once this initial stress wears off, so when does the wear and tear actually starts developing? So when is the point where the whole translocation becomes too much for the animal to handle, which is the golden question, and it's super difficult to analyze. But we try to look at a bunch of variables that are all associated with this stress response and get a closer idea about when the time point would be and if the interventions that we test actually do make a difference.
And are there any projects currently going on in Vienna that you are involved with as your own research?
Yeah, so we have a PhD student that is looking into how to minimize the side effects of etorphin anesthesia in wild ungulates using sheep as a model. So etorphin, that's the drug I mentioned at the beginning when I talked about challenges when working with rhinos, that causes all these things like respiratory depression, ventilation perfusion mismatch, a rigid chest, tremors, hyperthermia, hypertension, pulmonary hypertension. And those side effects also occur when you use these drugs in other animals, like sheep or wild ungulates. And she is now looking into using butinoxan or BIMU-8 to mitigate some of those side effects. So it's going to be a very sophisticated anesthesia study in collaboration with the Institute of Anesthesiology here in Vienna, and actually also with the University of Pretoria in South Africa. And we will train our sheep to be habituated to slings and to handling. And I'm already very excited about that study.
Well, thanks so much, Fidu, for sharing your experiences and talking about your day-to-day life as a wildlife researcher. Yeah, thanks so much for being my guest on the show.
Thank you. It's amazing to be on your show.
Thanks for listening to the Wildlife Health Talks. We will be back with a new story in 2 weeks. Bye for now.